Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice from the Carlson Center in Fairbanks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The 2013 Alaska Federation of Natives Convention wraps up today. This year's speeches and presentations covered a range of topics that are relevant to all Alaska Native communities, like subsistence rights and healthy living. Today we want to talk about how leaders in the interior are addressing some of the most pressing issues in their villages and towns. Subsistence rights advocate Katie John passed away earlier this year. Some of her family members will share their thoughts on her legacy. We'll also talk about domestic violence in interior villages, efforts to turn out the Native vote, and safety of young people. Join us for a discussion on some of the tribal priorities and a look at what's next after the conclusion of AFN, right after this news update.
Reporting from the Federation of Natives Convention in Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Friday's session of AFN began with speeches from co-chair nominees, followed by the presentation of three annual awards. AFN President Julie Kitka bestowed the Citizen of the Year Award upon longtime Juneau educator Tony Malott, who's originally from Rampart in the Yukon River region. The 2013 Denali Award honored Dr. Larry Kaplan, director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Native Language Center, for his years of contributions in preserving and restoring Alaska Native languages. The AFN Elder of the Year Award was given to Robert Marshall of Chitna. Representative Bryce Edgman, chairman of the Bush Caucus, gave a report on activities in this year's session. He stated that the caucus was opposed to the oil tax cut and urged voters to educate themselves before the public vote on whether or not to repeal it next August. Edgman announced the introduction of a bill that would allow communities to decide whether or not to arm their village public safety officers, then wrapped up by stating that the Bush Caucus is in support of the expansion of Medicaid.
In strong support, urging the governor to accept the Alaska's ability to enroll more people in the Medicaid program. In our view, there's no reason not to accept the tremendous amount of money that would come to the federal government.
How much money? $1.1 billion that would allow 40,000 more Alaskans over a seven-year period access to health care. In an emotional session Friday, Cynthia Erickson, a store owner from Tanana, took the stage along with a group of seven kids to tremendous applause to speak about what leads to suicide and what it will take to prevent it.
But the thing is, we can talk and we can talk and we can talk and we can meet here for another 50 years and we can continue to talk. But it's like we have seven people here today that are walking their talk. It's up to you guys to support these same seven children that are hurting from all of this.
The children held up handwritten signs with some of the problems they've seen firsthand: drugs, molestation, and alcohol. Each one spoke, sharing their own stories of suicide and abuse in their families. At the end, a young man read a pledge.
I pledge to live, honor, and protect myself from any harm, to love my life, my family, my friends, and my village. Today we stand together to stop suicide in Alaska.
The audience was visibly moved, with hundreds of audience members spontaneously streaming to the stage to give money in support of the young people and their anti-suicide message, while the traditional Tanana dance group began to sing. Senator Mark Begich took the stage next, recounting his recent travels around the state and saying he wants to help make sure tribes are recognized in Alaska. He says he supported the passing of the Affordable Care Act because it also ensured the reauthorization of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act. He voiced support for voting rights and the ability to vote in Alaska's indigenous languages. Members of the AFN Subsistence Committee formed at last year's convention discussed subsistence rights and protections. Myron Nanick, president of the Association of Village Council Presidents, explains the current plan for tribes along the Yukon and Kuskokwim Rivers to manage their own resources. What is the Intertribal Fishery Commission?
The Intertribal Fish Commission would be working with the tribes, and we're trying to get legislation introduced as a demonstration project that would allow our tribes to be involved in fishery management. Right now, there are so many fish managers, like the state and the feds, they don't even include traditional knowledge or even include our tribes in any of the management systems, as well as the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council.
A champion of tribal fishing rights, Billy Frank Jr. from Washington, also spoke during the subsistence session. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
AFN newscasts produced by Quahonic Broadcast Corporation. Major funding provided by the Siri Foundation, ConocoPhillips, South Central Foundation, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Donlin Gold, the Pebble Partnership, the Rasmussen Foundation, Jalista Corporation, and Manilik Association. You can help the broadcast by taking the AFN listener survey at knba.org. This is a production of KNBA, Quahonic Broadcast Corporation, and Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Since Thursday, Alaska's First People have met in Fairbanks to discuss priorities and address issues in their communities. Healthcare, education, energy, and resource management are among some of the topics delegates have focused on at the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention. People from across the state have gathered here in the interior, with 42 Native communities here in the interior. And joining me now to talk about some of the interior priorities are Jerry Isaac, Steve Guinness, and Victor Joseph. Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice. Jerry, I'll start with you. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Jerry Isaac. I'm the Tanana Chiefs President, Chairman of the Board. I'm from Tanana Cross.
Okay, and Steve, please introduce yourself.
I'm Steve Guinness. I'm from Kutchajir, which is Fort Yukon. Born and raised there, currently residing in Fairbanks. And I'm the Executive Director of the Fairbanks Native Association.
And Victor, please introduce yourself.
Victor Joseph, and I'm the Tanana Chiefs Health Director. My membership is with the Tanana Tribe, and I reside in Fairbanks.
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about some of these issues facing Interior Alaska, and just talking to delegates this week. There's someone important to the Interior that is being missed here at AFN. We got a chance to talk to Fred John Jr. He's the son of Katie John. Katie John had 12 children, 14 born to her, and she took care of other children.
You know, Chiefs salute to people come back when they pass away to our home village. She tell us she don't want no gun shooting, or she don't want to be buried with a bunch of beads and all the natives. She want to be buried just as a person. She always say, make me really big. He said, people make me really big, but I can't be big by myself. He said, just people make me big, meaning that people really look up to her and everything. She's really kind. When she greets you, she greets you, you're going to just love her. And what I like mostly about is that she's been pretty tough on us, lovingly tough. One time we asked one of my friends, one of my family asked her, how come you're so tough on us? He said, because you were taught and you know better. What about those people? He said, you got to make sure that they learn too. He said, because she wasn't really hard on them. Because they didn't, you know, they weren't taught that hard. But we were taught from her really hard and really good way. And she expects us to walk that walk. And I think we are. We're going to carry on for her. We're going to do our best to just carry on and the subsistent case and everything. Remind everybody that it had to go on. Our people had to fight. She belonged to all Alaska now. She doesn't belong to just our family now. She belonged to everybody in Alaska. And I'm glad she is.
And Katie John is remembered for fighting for the traditional way of life of not only just the people here, but all across Alaska. And I have one more clip I'd like to share with you, and then we'll get some of your memories of Katie John. This is Catherine Martin. She's the granddaughter of Katie John and worked
as Vice President of Land and Resources for Otna.
I just, I can hear her, you know, telling me, you know, our traditional ways. I mean, I was thinking back, you know, just sitting here at AFN because she's not here this year. This is the first year without her. She's always been at AFN, whether she traveled with me or not, you know, she was always here. And I was thinking about it that, you know, she always stood up, you know, to, you know, for subsistence, but she mostly always stood up for our cultural and our traditional ways. She said, never forget where you came from, never forget who you are. And that was, I think, one of the things that also she used, that why she prevailed. You know, she's like, I was raised on Tanata Creek. That's where she was raised, and she would say that I was raised off that creek. Meaning that, you know, she got her life from that, you know, through her parents and grandmother. So I'm just sitting here, you know, listening, and I just know that, you know, she's still here, and, you know, the presence, I mean, just so many people have honored her, you know, and making in their comments and whatnot. So to me, I was like, you know, she's still here, even though she's physically not here.
And those were voices of some of Katie John's family talking about her and her being missed at AFN. Jerry, let's start with you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In regards to the late Grandma Katie John, she's a member of my father's side clan. She lived about 40, maybe 50 miles from where I live. I live in Tana Cross. I'm from Tana Cross. She's from Mentassa Lake, Manzanita area, which is like 50 miles south of Toke. And she was one of the renowned elders. Many times authority, under authority, we defer to her. Her and several other elders, some of whom are not with us anymore. One of the elders in the area is Robert Marshall, who was just honored the other day. Katie John was remembered for many things. She was a hardy lady. From stories that I've heard, she raised her children completely on subsistence living. So, you know, I agree with what her son Freddie, was saying about his mother, where stories of hardships were told, and she was highly respected for being a very sturdy lady who helped support her family. And she was caring enough to tell you, to keep you straight in terms of advice.
And Steve, what is subsistence like for people here?
Well, first, a comment on Katie John. I met her way back in the mid-90s when I was the chairman of the Alaska Intertribal Council. There was a march on subsistence in Anchorage. And that was the first opportunity that I had to meet Katie John. And of course, later on, I became the president of Tanana Chiefs Conference, and subsistence was at the forefront. And she was a strong advocate for the Alaska Native peoples, not just in her region or just within the Tanana Chiefs area, but statewide. And for someone that really came from the land and didn't really have the formal education, she's made a real impact. And her case went as far as the Supreme Court of the nation. And you know, I think fondly of her and her leadership that she provided for all of us. In terms of subsistence, you know, I don't use that word. I think it's taken out of context. I think that subsistence doesn't describe our people's way of life. And as far as I know, subsistence means some kind of monetary value. And our way of life is not described in a monetary way. It's surviving off the land, that we've been taught for many, many years over the years and passed on down to generations to come. And I think it's really unfortunate that the state of Alaska hasn't really recognized that. I think it's very unfortunate that they haven't included that in the constitutional amendment as part of the constitution. And I think it's high time that they really recognize the indigenous people of the state. And this whole issue they call subsistence is one that at some point in time some powers to be will come to a realization that we're talking about people's way of life.
And Victor, do you have something to add on Katie John or the challenges facing Native people in the interior when it comes to their hunting and traditional practices?
Well, first let me say, you know, I didn't get to know Katie John as well as others, but that didn't minimize the impact that she had on me or our family or the tribal members throughout Alaska or even on the state of Alaska. And I was listening to her son speak about her, and the value that really carries forward is how modest she was even though she achieved such greatness. And that really speaks highly of our tribal people. When I think about that initiative and, you know, her struggle and her fight to have and get fish, it was very important because we still struggle with that same fight today. It was a real strong movement. It had a lot of people talking on a state and national area, and now we're having those same battles again. But now it's over the amount of fish that are coming up the river for our people, and the complications of it being both commercial and subsistence, and that battle between the two groups. And how do we find balance between the two? And so for us, making sure that we have enough king salmon coming up the river to feed our people is very important. At the same time, when we look at this, we look at the other animals that our people rely on to put food on their table. And, you know, and these are natural resources that we look at and expect to have that we're not having anymore. When we look at the cost of what people have to pay to live out in some of our rural communities, gas being anywhere from $5 to $10, depending on how they get it in, a gallon of milk costing, you know, anywhere from $8 to $10. There's really a high price to pay, so their reliance on our native foods are very important.
Well, today on Alaska's Native Voice, we're looking at interior issues, and we have three guests joining us today who live here, and we're talking about some of the things that have been discussed at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. And one thing that we heard is health and wellness, and that's addressed both at the Elders and Youth Conference that was held earlier in the week and at the AFN Convention. And we did get to speak to Catherine Gottlieb, who's President and CEO of South Central Foundation, and she talked about men's wellness, and I think wellness of people across Alaska, even in here in the interior, and men's wellness is an important issue.
They talked about stepping forward and being involved in getting in the activity of prevention by paying attention as parents. Stop watching a lot of TV. Instead, take your child out, even to throw rocks across the lake. And I just thought it was great the way the men put it together, encouraging the parents to stand up and pay attention to their children and give them a hug. Our men have a hard toe of life today because these warrior men that we have in our Alaska Native American Indian men were the sole breadwinners in my lifetime. And in my lifetime, that role has changed where a lot of us have to go to work, women have to go to work alongside of the men. Subsistence have changed. We can't just go out hunting and getting our food like we used to. Fishing has changed. The rules around that, and also how the diminishing of our resources have happened around fishing. So now all these roles have changed. How can we have our men step forward and still continue to be the strong role models they are when they have to work 24 hours a day and then have all the hardships that happen along with everything else from the historical events that have ever happened to us and the traumas that have happened to us. So what's happening now is what I believe is that our men are paying attention. They're stepping up to the plate. They're calling out each other for wellness and saying we've got to end domestic violence, child abuse, and child neglect. We've got to end the traumas that are happening in our lives and to support our families. Be strong.
And to go along with that, we spoke with Aaron Schott, who is the president and CEO of Doyon Limited, and he talked about some of the things that they're doing to help men in this area.
That's part of the crisis we have in Native Alaska and in our part of Alaska and the interior. We have a lot of young men who are not living healthy lifestyles. And so some things we're doing within our company to try and alleviate that are create training programs and other opportunities for young men so that they can be good providers, so that they have opportunities to do things that are positive rather than hopefully they stay away from the bad things, the drugs, alcohol, abuse, the other situations that are so destructive in our village communities.
And Jerry, how can having men's wellness help in creating healthy communities?
The ideal Native family led by a Native father would have a well-defined, healthy lifestyle that includes a balanced lifestyle of, you know, for example, eating healthy food, doing healthy things, having a spiritual commitment of sorts, whether it's Native spirituality or whether it's Christian or what other belief, doesn't matter as long as it contributes to the wholeness of the family. You know, because of the intergenerational breakdown of responsibilities, it's not only caused by economic forces, it was caused by policy. It was caused by the forceful removal of Native children to boarding schools. It was caused by the authorities trying to beat the Native out of Native men. They created instead a hollow shell that is full of confusion. And, you know, as a result, right now, today, we have a high rate of dysfunctional situations, alcohol and drug abuse, sexual as well as physical abuse of women and children. These are byproducts of the forceful policies that was exercised by the government and the churches. I know I can stir up a lot of controversy about that, but even the established churches have espoused a very strong disciplinary behavior and ideals on Native kids that were in religious institutions. So, you know, in order for us to arrest or even try to get the record straight, number one, we have to work on reestablishing the healthy identity of who we are. And there should not be any embarrassment about speaking our language and doing Native things. One of it is Native dancing and singing. One of it is speaking our language fluently. You know, institutionally, we were forced to abandon all of that. And it's a good thing that some of us clung on to the old order, so to speak.
And Steve, your take on this issue?
Well, I think I think we need to really be honest with ourselves. regarding alcohol and drug abuse in our communities. Sometimes I feel like we're in denial that we have a problem like this that leads to all kinds of problems. And you know, when one gets up to speak about this issue, some people are offended. And what I keep reminding people is that I'm not talking specifically about you. I'm talking about the community and how the community needs to heal. And I think once we can get a handle on that, I think all these other issues will be addressed, because we'll have clean and sober people, clean and sober leaders, and all contributing for the good of the community. So that's kind of my take on it.
And Victor, what are some of the things that the Tanana Chiefs Conference is doing to help people with some of the issues that we're talking about when it comes to wellness of men?
Well, first of all, I believe what it... I just need to say one thing before I jump into that, and it was about those kids, that those Tanana kids that stood up on the stage the other day, and they said, and they voiced, no more. They talked about no more suicide. They talked about no more domestic violence, no more sexual abuse. These are the things that live strong in our communities. I go back to when I was a young man, and I asked my grandmother, I said, how come you didn't teach me Indian? And the response that I got back was real powerful. And it came in the terms of a single teardrop. Because she was removed from her home, put into a school, and whenever she spoke her language, she was beat. And so what I realize now is that she didn't teach me out of love. And it took me a long time to figure that out. As I look at what Tanana Chiefs are doing, we're going to be having a conference coming up on November 6th and 7th, and we're going to be talking about just that. What do we do about alcohol and drugs that are impacting our community?
Okay. Well, today on Alaska's Native Voice, we're talking about some of the issues that are being discussed here at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, and we're also focusing on the interior and how... What are these issues like here? We have three guests joining us today, and we have a lot more coming up. We've touched on the traditional way of life and some of the challenges when it comes to hunting and fishing. And we've talked a little bit about men's health, but we have to take a short break. We'll be right back and get into more of these issues. Welcome back to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today we're taking a look at some of the priorities for Alaska Native people in the interior. People from across the state have gathered here in Fairbanks this week for the Elders and Youth Conference that was earlier in the week, and the 2013 Alaska Federation of Natives Annual Convention. And joining me is three guests, Jerry Isaac, Steve Guinness, and Victor Joseph, and they're here talking about some of these issues facing the interior today. Thank you all for joining me. Welcome back. And Jerry, we saw just a few minutes ago a rally behind the Fairbanks Four. Can you explain a little bit about the Fairbanks Four?
Generally speaking, the Native community had felt all along that these four young Native men were convicted on unsubstantiated evidence, and also the fabrication of evidence. The Native community feel that their due process was violated. That's what I've been saying all along, too, is that I failed to see where there was fairness in the processes that was used to gather information. There was suppression of evidence that was crucial to the defense. These practices are very unfair. In a court of law, you're guaranteed certain privileges. One of the privileges is the guarantee of due process, which essentially to me, it means that you are given a free, fair exposure to the types of evidence that is to be used in defense of yourself as well as the prosecution's offense. There has got to be a level of noticeable fairness in this whole process, and in the case of these four young men, there was no noticeable fairness in the process, and I challenge that.
And Steve, looking at this case, what does that mean when it comes to justice among Alaska Native people?
Well, first of all, regarding the Fairbanks Four, I was one of those people initially that thought they were guilty. But after reviewing the interrogation of them and reading all that material, I came to the conclusion that these four were innocent. And in terms of your question, I think one of the areas that we need to push, I guess you might say, at least in the Fairbanks community, is to recruit for Native policemen in Fairbanks. And I also believe that it's crucial to have some type of cross-cultural education for these officers that don't understand Native people. I think that would be a step in the right direction.
And just to clarify for our audience, Jerry, these were four men who were convicted and are serving time for a murder. Is that correct?
Yes. In 1997, October, they were charged with the murder of a young non-Native gentleman by the name of John Hartman.
Okay. And Victor, do you have anything to add on the Fairbanks Four case?
Well, there's... when you look at this whole case, there's a lot of frustration and there's a lot of mistrust between the Native community and our judicial system. That needs to be healed. If we cannot believe in our judicial system, then we're never going to have equality. And I think that's going to be really important. I also think I want to expand on Steve's response a little bit, and I think he made an important point about the cultural sensitivity and that all the officers should be trained in that. It's just not the officers that need to be trained in it. It's all people in that whole system that need to be trained and go through that. It's also important to realize that we do need fair processes as we look at and in terms of how Native people are treated. Historically, our people have had been given longer sentences for similar crimes of their non-tribal members. They've been given representation that always wants to deal out. And so those are the things that we have to continually work on and make sure that we talk to our younger people about not getting engaged in this whole area.
And it brings up the question about tribal courts. And here in the interior, so, one of the things that we heard among the delegates is that the court system here. Can you talk a little bit about the tribal courts, Jerry?
Tribal courts are a system that has been a part of the traditional fabric of the Native community. You know, a great deal of the time, people think, you know, in the state that tribal courts should emulate the state or the federal courts. Yet, traditionally, court systems were established to handle disagreements in a community, and this has been centuries. It's alive and well, and people have allegiance to tribal governments and its institutions. That's the problem, is that the predominant society does not see that there is allegiance to traditional institutions like tribal courts. It's like you're trying to snuff the nativeness out of people. I'm from Tana Cross, and the native village of Tana Cross has got a tribal court. And I pledge allegiance to the sanctity of that tribal court. And it does not have to emulate the processes and/or the methods used by the state or the federal courts. Judges are made up of tribal councils, or the people of authority, positions of authority, and it could be varied. It could be grandmothers. It could be grandfathers. It could be speech makers. It could be potlatch makers. The makeup of it is made up of people with substantial character, and I see no reason for any entity to come into the community, into the tribe, and to try to dismantle systems that's been there forever. And that's my take on that.
And Steve, there have been in the state of Alaska, there has been a challenge to a tribal court case. What is your take on that?
Well, first of all, I think Fort Yukon, during the time I was a chief of Fort Yukon, I think our case was probably the first one that was elevated through the court system. And it had to do with a tribal court making a decision on an adoption case. And we did the right thing. The young person grew up to be productive, got an education, got a job, is married, etc. So the state of Alaska challenged that decision we made, basically saying that we didn't have authority to do that. So I do believe, I believe in the tribal court system. And like Jerry said, before there was even a tribal court, our traditional chief referred to as Indian law from way back. And growing up in Fort Yukon, tribal council governed the community, and they had ordinances in place. So, for example, there was no drunk in public. You couldn't have loose dogs around running around the community. Listen, those type of things. And they enforced it. If you violated any of those ordinances, you came before the tribal council, where they discuss your situation and fine you or whatever. Sorry about that. Until the state government began to recognize the authority of tribal governments in the state, including tribal courts, we're going to continue, I think, to have these litigation cases. And that's very unfortunate for tribes that want to exercise their right to do these type of things.
And Victor, anything to add?
Well, for me, and I'll just personalize this a little bit. As a young kid, I was removed from my family and placed in a non-tribal home instead of my relatives' homes. And the difference in the problems that I had to go through there were a lot greater than when I was able to be staying with some people that I knew and loved. And so there was some great deals in that. Also, too, having gone through the tribal court system for my own grandson and watching that, there needs to be that balance and where we all respect that tribal court system and respect their rulings. And that needs to happen not only on a tribal level, but also on a statewide level. And I think we're going to be getting there, and I think they have a very important role as we look at the self-governance of our people.
Well, today on Alaska's Native Voice, we are here at the Carlson Center at the Alaska Federation of Natives 2013 Annual Convention, and we're talking about delegates, what they're, some of the issues they're focusing on here, and some of the priorities among tribes. And we are focusing on the interior because that's where the conference is being held this year. And we have three guests joining us. And something that is going on in the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention and also the Elders and Youth Conference was talking about doing your civic duty and voting, whether it's in a tribal, state, or national election. And so one of the speakers at the Elders and Youth Conference this year was Daisy Stevens, who is Gwich'in.
On the morning of September 16th, 2011, I took the day off to spend time with my mother, Hannah Paul Solomon, who was 102 years old. While my siblings and I were sitting with my mother, her mail came in. My sister told her that her village corporation ballot had come in. She stated that she wanted to vote. We were all there when she voted her ballot. We didn't know who she voted for. She never did tell us who she voted for. 3 hours later, my mother passed away. Her ballot was already in the mail, and her vote counted. My mother taught me how important it is to vote, no matter what is going on.
And that was a speech at the Elders and Youth Conference with Daisy Stevens, who is working on Get Out the Native Vote here in the interior. And Jerry?
In the years past, we've had problems with voter turnout. Part of the reasons, in my opinion, is because of the way the Native people have been treated publicly. On a general scale, it appears that our voice does not count, and the prevailing attitude because of that is, why should I vote? It doesn't count anyways. Which is tragic because, you know, in the annals of American history, you know, the founding fathers, the so-called founding fathers, their ideals were that the citizenry should have the authority to pick their leaders. Oftentimes, as a Native leader, I most often doubt the capacity and capability of the United States and Alaska is able to fulfill its true creed of espousing ideals based upon individual freedoms. But, you know, just because we have difficulty with voter turnout does not mean we should give up hope that we cannot get people to exercise their very basic right to choose their leadership. So we have been working very hard here in the interior to try to get the awareness out and to coordinate activities that would encourage voter registration and voter turnout. I have not announced it publicly yet, but we have a even a bigger voter concert planned for next year's convention in Anchorage. I have contacts in the lower 48 that are going to contact professional musicians and artists to perform at this concert so that we can encourage voter turnout and registration. You know, the percentage of voter turnout has been 50% or less. It's discouraging, but like I say, we're doing all we can to encourage people to recognize that they have the basic right to vote and they need to make it an important function in their lives, like the late grandma Hannah Paul Zalman.
And Steve, what about the power that Native people have when they vote? It was evident with U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who she credits the Native people for her write-in campaign that she won. So the power, Steve.
Well, you know, I think today, because of technology and more information being provided, that I think our folks can begin to make a good informed decision of who they believe would be supportive of our efforts. I think that's what's evolving here. And more of our people are getting into the voting booth. And I think we all recognize the importance of some of these issues that have serious impact on our people. And these folks that run for office certainly can make a difference for us. And so in case of Murkowski, you know, the Native community all came together. They voted for her, and obviously she got reelected. So I think we can do that with a governor's race coming up. And I'm very hopeful that Byron Mallott will be our next governor of the state, the first Native governor ever. And, you know, I think our people will, you'll see a real increase in voter turnout in this particular election next year.
And at AFN, you see Get Out the Native Vote efforts. There was a concert this week, and then there's also, they've been on the stage talking about it. There's people wearing T-shirts with the pilot bread and the Get Out the Native Vote. And then at the Elders and Youth Conference, not only did Daisy speak about why people should vote, but they also had an exercise where they let the elders and youth vote. So they had a little polling booths over here, and they asked them, I believe it was about four questions on issues pertaining to Alaska Native people here in the state. So Victor, we any kind of follow-up to the voting that Jerry and Steve were talking about?
Well, the voting is very important to our tribal people. As we look at it, yes, the tribal vote did help Senator Murkowski and was very important to her reelection. But back several years ago, Tony Knowles also was carried by, Governor Tony Knowles was also carried by the Native vote. You know, recently in the Fairbanks area, we just had a new city mayor, John Ebenhart, who was elected and was supported by the tribal community. In return, what that had was a council member was put in his place, and who is a tribal member. So as we see not only getting out more to vote, it does create change. For the first time ever, Fairbanks has a Native person on the city council. That's significant. As we look at the possibility of having a governor, as we look at the possibility of maybe even having a lieutenant governor, that may be tribal or any positions, I think that's going to really change the makeup of the way the state sees our tribal people.
And with the AFN convention wrapping up today, you know, the work doesn't end, as tribal leaders know that it continues, and not only here in the state and in your communities, but on the national level. And Jerry, you are going to be representing the Alaska region with the National Congress of American Indians. And, you know, there's a lot of federal leaders who come here to both Elders and Youth and AFN to talk about different federal priorities. We did even get a chance this week to talk to U.S. Senator Mark Begich, and let's hear what he had to say.
One of the things I'm going to do with many that come visit me is give them kind of the list of senators they need to go talk to. Because since I've been there in 5 years, 35 new senators have come into the U.S. Senate. 35, that's a lot. And some of them have no idea of the issues that tribes are dealing with. So what I want to do is kind of make the list and say, I'm there with you already. Here's who I need you to go talk to, because I can tell you, why is there veterans care now? In every clinic around this state, it's because a tribal leader I brought to Washington, D.C., beside Shinseki coming to Bethel region, I had a conference that I chaired and had an individual there and gave his story as an Alaskan Native veteran. And once he gave that story in front of other organizations, veterans organizations and agencies, it changed their minds overnight. I know the stories are going to be fantastic. We have to have them go in front of some of our adversaries, and some people don't know. And it's tough, because human nature is what? Go to where it's friendly, comfortable. But I need the Alaska tribes to go to some of the people, and that's what I'll be doing. So I'll be sitting with them saying, okay, 5-10 minutes with me, but here's your list. Let's go get busy. And some of these people just want to learn. They don't know. They're from states that, you know, New York, for example. I can tell you the two centers there do very little about tribal issues, even though there are some tribes in New York, but they don't, you know, they're mostly around New York City stuff. So if I can expose them to a couple of these things, maybe they become more friendly about our issues, and that's what we need to be doing.
And that was U.S. Senator Mark Begich, and he was talking about the upcoming Tribal Leaders Conference by the Obama administration with President Obama that is coming up here, and with the National Congress of American Indians. Jerry, what do you have to say about Senator Begich saying that the work tribes need to go beyond just lobbying with lawmakers in the U.S. Congress who are friendly with, but to go and talk to and educate the other lawmakers who don't really have a lot of maybe tribes in their area or even some knowledge on Indian issues?
Upon my experience, especially in this last 7.5 years as president of TCC, I've had the opportunity to talk with people who are not supportive of Native American issues and or are unaware of them. And I do sympathize with the concerns expressed by Senator Begich in that much has to be done in terms of advocacy and representation. It does not suffice for us to only approach our congressional delegation, because there's only three of them. They serve on various committees and subcommittees. And there's members of those subcommittees and committees that are made up of representatives and senators from various states across the nation. Oftentimes, some of them are, you know, are from the political extraction of the extreme right, extremely Republican-type views. And their ideas are that you do not expend public monies for anything that is not a basic function to the health of the nation. And the Native Americans, little do they understand that the Native Americans have a constitutional provision that racially identifies them as a unit of people that the United States government will be dealing with. The Constitution does not say that they have to deal with anybody else or anything by race identification. only the Native Americans were identified in the Constitution. So, you know, in order for us to effectively advocate, not only do we have to go and talk with our congressional delegation, but what Senator Begich has been saying is go and talk to the other policymakers, other, not only the administration, but the other senators and representatives across the nation so that we can educate them onto Native issues.
Okay, and we're getting to the end of our program, but Steve, I want to give you a chance to respond.
Well, you know, what Senator Begich is expressing is nothing new to us. You know, I think it's crucial that we know who our friends are and who are not. And those that don't support our efforts are the ones that need to be educated. And so I've learned that being on the Hill in D.C. over the years, is that those that you know may or don't want to support your position are the ones that you go spend time with and try to educate them on the issues.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for joining us today. And Victor, your final thought on today's program?
Well, overall, you know, it was pretty good. And for me, when I look, but I want to go back to this, it's this whole question about Senator Begich's remark. For me, really what's important is that, and what he's stressing, is we got to talk to not only our friends, but those that are not. And it's always easy to talk to our friends, but as true leaders, we always have to go and advocate where it's the hardest at. And I just want to thank you for this opportunity here.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today. Jerry Isaac, thank you for being on our program. And Steve Guinness, also thank you for being on our program today. And Victor Joseph, we appreciate your time, all of you, and thanks for our listening audience out there. We've been broadcasting from the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention, which was held, kicked off Thursday here in Fairbanks, Alaska. And today we focused on issues facing people in the interior. And thanks to our board operator and producer, Sarah Gustavus. I've been your host, Antonia Gonzalez.
Alaska's Native Voice, produced and anchored by Antonia Gonzalez. Technical operations by Sarah Gustavus. Major funding provided by the Siri Foundation, ConocoPhillips, South Central Foundation, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Donlin Gold, the Pebble Partnership, the Rasmussen Foundation, Jalista Corporation, and Manilik Association. You can help the broadcast by taking the AFN Listener Survey at knba.org. This is a production of KNBA, Quahonic Broadcast Corporation, and Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.